Thanks for downloading this podcast from The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and if you're ready, we'll begin. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening to public radio, which is safe and measured, sometimes maybe a little formulaic sounding, easy to parody. Can you tell me a little bit about your sustainable carpentry? Hard to precisely pin down, but you know it when you hear it. That everybody sounds the same, All Things Edition American Life Companion. You know, that's public radio. This hour, how much does public radio say public? How much does it say white? How much does the force of its vocal tone compel people to sound more white, to sound public radio? What do you think about that? Later this hour, someone who has lived that experience, actually two people if you count me. Did you know that I'm white? Bet you didn't, right? Just like Eminem. Does public radio mean white sounding? Also, the parallel universe of jails in the United States, a warehouse for people, not justice. We'll look at Rikers Island right here in New York. But we begin with a positive trend in the Ebola crisis. The exponential growth of infections seems to have hit a plateau. The World Health Organization says that there were fewer than 100 confirmed new cases of the disease reported last week. That's the lowest since late June. The United Nations Health Agency says beyond simply containment of Ebola, eradication is the next goal. Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt is Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee. He just returned from Liberia yesterday. Welcome back, Doctor.
Thank you.
So I noticed right at the top you said, good of you to shake my hand, which says to you that the hysteria back in the United States about Ebola may have diminished a little bit.
Yes, absolutely. One feels a different climate, and the reception at the airport was very professional and I think appropriate from a public health perspective.
What do you think of the World Health Organization's notions that maybe the trend line has moved downward?
I think it's correct, at least in Sierra Leone and Liberia. From what we know, there's been a dramatic reduction in cases, and we're entering a different phase of the epidemic. In Guinea, it's less sure, and there's concern about getting hidden cases. That was the reason that the epidemic surged in the first place. But in Sierra Leone and Liberia, there's far fewer cases. However, it's important to note that doesn't mean the epidemic is over. It means it's in a different phase in which a different approach and different types of actions are needed.
What worked to get us to this point?
Well, that's a really important question, John, to find out what worked, because people who don't understand the past are condemned to repeat it, as we've heard around the Auschwitz commemoration. And in this case, if we don't understand what actually beat the epidemic, we are going to have a tough time preventing future ones and even completely ending this one. And the short answer is it's the community. Everyone is saying it. It's crystal clear. It's the emergence of natural leaders within the community and a renewed sense of community purpose around life-threatening, community-ending possibly danger. And communities all over Liberia and Sierra Leone really rallied. In some cases, they got support. I'm proud to say that I feel the IRC was very active in supporting communities. But as one of IRC's own staff said, what really works is when the community is ahead. If you're leading the community into something, that's not going to work. You need to have the community make the decisions about what's working and what's not working.
We talk about this so much, but this is citizen-driven healthcare, and it's in the middle of a crisis. But when the community is mobilized ahead of the doctors and it stops being a top-down kind of thing, real miracles can happen.
Absolutely. And in fact, it's almost more needed in a crisis because as a number of people, especially in public health, have known for a long time, citizen-driven healthcare is what's needed. It's what works best. And in a crisis, you don't have any choice. You have to do things that work. Unfortunately, it took us, the global community, a few months to discover this.
What about the virus has changed?
I don't think that this one has evolved dramatically. I think what's changed is what needs to be done. At the height of the epidemic, at its unprecedented height, we were playing what people called the 70-70 game. We're trying to get 70% of the burials done in safe conditions, 70% of the cases and contacts traced. But now we're in the phase of the epidemic where it's a 100% game, and that's much more difficult. Quality as well as quantity are essential. So the disease is still popping up occasionally. Every one of those cases represents a big danger for reigniting the epidemic. So all over the countries, all over in every health facility, we have to be aware that a case could be Ebola, and we have to be ready, and we have to not miss a single one. And that's a very tall order.
You've talked about citizens mobilized in this crisis, but I'm wondering if the society as a whole feels beaten down to you or confident moving forward, that the one of the permanent legacies might be a sense that disaster can strike at any moment.
I had very long conversations on this trip with our teams in Liberia, but also teams who came to visit from Sierra Leone and even from Mali, and I got a sense of optimism and of strength. And I think it's coming from the fact people know that they beat this virus. Maybe the rest of the world doesn't know it, but it's not the foreign medical teams. It's not the WHO. It's they who did it, and they know that. And I think that gives them a sense of optimism and confidence for the future that I found really inspiring.
That's a remarkable story. Do they dare to believe eradication is within sight?
Absolutely. They're very focused on that. And I heard that message over and over, not only from our staff, but from our partners, that the fight is not over. And they know, just as they knew how to get it, you know, from 500 cases a week to less than 20, they also know how to get it from 20 to zero. And the important thing for us is to listen. There was someone who said, someone who works in the community, and he said, if only people had talked to me earlier on, I could have done so much more.
Just returned from Liberia, Dr. Emmanuel Darcourt is Senior Health Director for the International Rescue Committee with a very optimistic message there. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
It's too early to fully assess the lessons of this Ebola crisis, but one person at least may be certain about experiences he doesn't want to repeat. Dr. Craig Spencer contracted Ebola while working with Doctors Without Borders in West Africa. Dr. Spencer first exhibited symptoms back in October. He eventually found himself at Bellevue Hospital in New York City after reporting a fever. His case, you'll recall, produced a media hysteria worthy of, say, an overhyped blizzard. Mary Harris, senior producer for health reporting at WNYC, was able to speak with Dr. Spencer, who for the first time talked frankly about what he hopes will be different next time. Mary, welcome to the show.
Hi, John.
So how did you find Dr. Spencer?
You know, he's really still recovering from everything he went through. Everything he went through while he was in West Africa, all the death he saw, and everything he went through when he came back here. He really feels violated by everything the press put him through and by the policies that were put in place by the governors of New York and New Jersey.
Let's recall the sort of slip into Ebola that he had personally himself.
When I woke up that morning, I didn't feel quite right. I was breathing a little faster and I felt a little warm and I suspected that maybe I wasn't okay. So I got up and sat on the couch and thought for a second and took my temperature. And it was 100.3, later misquoted as 103, but 100.3. In a way, for that one brief second, it was almost a sigh of relief. Because the moment that I had been fearing and concerned about had kind of arrived, and I felt at that moment like not at peace with being infected, but almost could stop worrying about getting it if it had already come.
Dr. Craig Spencer telling the story of contracting Ebola with Mary Harris for the first time. So I'm wondering if some of that relief came from the fact that, well, I'm not in West Africa. I'm here in the United States. Everything's going to be okay. Didn't work out that way.
Yeah, I mean, definitely that was the relief for him. He speaks specifically about that. And honestly, his guilt at all of the attention he got, all of the treatment he got, and the fact that he couldn't have ever provided that to his patients in West Africa.
What did he find were the problems in the reaction here in the United States?
He was really upset with how the media got things wrong. His temperature, originally reported as 103, actually 100.3. There was some reporting that he lied to health department officials when he first reported his fever. That wasn't true either. Then there were little things, what band he liked, or that he was annoying nurses at Bellevue by playing the banjo, when actually the hospital had given him the banjo as a gift. So that's what really got him angry. What he found was that the difference here was that he had so much care. He had over 100 people dealing with his care. He had a CDC team. But then we, the public, couldn't really deal with the fact that he was an infected person.
It revealed a lot of weaknesses in a few different areas. One, how the media responded and how, at a time when they were responsible for informing the public about the fact that this was not the next pandemic, we weren't at a very substantial risk. In fact, we were at almost no risk. At a time when they were responsible for doing so, they didn't step up and do that. It is true that another concern of mine is that we have set a precedent for poor response to public health threats, not only across the globe in West Africa, where we were extremely slow to respond, but that we responded really poorly in many respects to this threat here in our own country.
Does he feel hurt?
It's a good question. I think that he does. He's a trusting guy. He's a nice guy. And I think he was just surprised at how strong the reaction was.
People thought that I should be, I forget what the exact tweet was, but tried for manslaughter. To this day, I've yet to see anything about my illness or my treatment, anything in the media that has been 100% factual. Everything that I've seen has been either partly wrong or completely wrong.
What does he attribute that backlash to, do you think?
I think he thinks it's the panic. A lot of doctors compared this to the AIDS panic in the 80s. A lot of people forget that in the 80s, Americans actually considered the idea of tattooing AIDS patients so that you knew when that threat was coming towards you. There's a New York Times poll from 1987, 29% of Americans thought this was a good idea. And that was very similar to what happened here. People wanted to know where the threat was. Was it at the meatball shop? Was it on the High Line? But was the threat really there at all? Probably not.
Well, it's a steep learning curve in the United States dealing with these kinds of healthcare issues. And quarantine isn't necessarily the solution. That's the other interesting point.
What the quarantine did is it set in place a precedent where we said, we trust you as a public health professional, as a doctor, as a nurse, as someone who is well enough trained and understanding enough about this virus to go and fight it at its source. But we don't trust you enough to take care of yourself and those around when you get back.
So, fine to go to West Africa, but we don't trust your judgment here in the United States. That's a terrible verdict. And public officials he blames for this in some ways.
Yeah, and you know, I talked to friends about my reporting as I was doing this, and very educated friends, good friends said, well, but the quarantine was a small price to pay. Of course his fiancée should have been quarantined. Of course we wanted to be careful with nurses like Casey Hickox, who came back and was the first person to kind of get caught up in the quarantine policy in New Jersey. But public health officials really don't agree with this. Ebola, you can't catch it before you have symptoms, and very strong symptoms, not even just fever. Even when you have that small fever, you're probably not shedding virus in a real way that will make you spread it to other people. Right now, we have this measles outbreak in California from Disneyland. You don't see governors getting on television and saying, we need to quarantine the family members of people with measles in their family. Even though that disease, it is infectious before you have symptoms.
Ebola became a photo op in Spencer's view.
Yeah.
Mary Harris, senior producer for health reporting at WNYC, with an exclusive interview with Dr. Craig Spencer. You can hear more of that interview at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much, Mary.
Thanks.
We've been talking about the hidden day-to-day world of law enforcement this week. Once cops make arrests, the accused go to jail. Long before a trial, jail is the warehouse netherworld where everyone is passing through, although some can end up staying indefinitely. Jail in America is something like the mysterious world of Guantanamo Bay. Uncertain trials, uncertain judgments about people being a danger to society, a holding pen, except unlike Gitmo, the jails are crowded. In Cook County, Illinois, the average jail population is 9,000, Los Angeles, 16,000. In New York, it's 11,400, most of them at the giant Rikers Island facility. The population at Rikers is coming down, but not nearly fast enough, says Martin Horn. He was the commissioner of the New York City Department of Correction from 2003 to 2009. He's now a distinguished lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice.
Rikers Island has really become the metaphor for criminal confinement in New York City, and it has become, over the years, New York's form of exile or purgatory. Much like Devil's Island in some respects. It is on this mountain of garbage in a place called Bowery Bay. To get to it, you have to cross a bridge that's located between the jet fuel depot for LaGuardia Airport on one side and a wastewater treatment plant on the other. And I think that's sort of a metaphorical description of this very desperate place where there are 10 jail buildings, 9 of which are operating. I think people often think of it as a single jail, but it's not.
What rights do people in jail have, or what are they supposed to have, and why are they, as you refer to, the forgotten population?
The vast majority of people in the jails on Rikers Island are defendants awaiting trial who have not yet been convicted of anything. And so they have certain due process rights guaranteed to them by the 14th Amendment, not to be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, not to be held on excessive bail. And they're also, they have the right not to be punished in cruel and unusual ways. Probably 10, no more than 20% of the prisoners out there are serving short sentences. In New York State, if you serve a sentence of less than a year, you do your time in local jail, which is Rikers Island.
Why do they enter this netherworld? Certainly at the point of arrest, there may be a headline, there may not be, but and at the point of trial, there's a focus on rights and due process. But in this sort of middle period, they seem to drop into a black hole.
Yeah. Well, there are two streams of prisoners that go through Rikers Island. It's very interesting when you really look at the data. Roughly 25% of the people who are admitted to the city's jails, not just Rikers Island, but all the city's jails, 25% of them are in and out within 3 days. 50% of the people that the city locks up are out within 2 weeks. But then if you stay longer than 2 weeks, the odds are you're going to stay a long time, on average 6 months. And there are some prisoners who remain awaiting trial for 2 years. And the reasons for this are varied. Part of it has to do with the way the judges in the city use bail and our reliance on money bail. The second thing is that some of these individuals languish for a long period of time. One must ask why some of these cases take as long as they do. In my conversations with corrections officials and in my own experience, the people who serve the longest time are very frequently the people who get into the most trouble. They're most often the prisoners who are predatory and victimize other prisoners, and also most often the people who are themselves victimized, others of them. So we really ought to concentrate on the long stayers, the people who stay a long time.
If judges were to prescribe bail more rationally, in your view, and take into account issues of whether someone is indigent or not, and you know, reasonable people can disagree about what's an appropriate bail or not, but if the number of people who could be released without bail were actually released, how much would the Rikers population go down, do you think?
I think that combining some bail reform and instituting some form of pretrial supervision and doing a better job of diverting some of the mentally ill who don't belong in jail and doing a better job of reducing the time it takes to dispose of some of these cases, you could probably bring the city's jail population down below 8,000 prisoners. I think on Christmas Day, it was at about 9,500, which was the lowest it's been in probably 30 years. I think you could, with not too much effort, get it down under 8,000, perhaps as low as 7,000 prisoners per day, which would actually give us fewer prisoners than the city of Philadelphia. And if you did that, it would allow you to rely far less on Rikers Island.
Finally, you mentioned the mental illness problem in places like Rikers. As the population would decline under bail reform, does Rikers and jails like it become more like mental health facilities, sort of default warehouses for the mentally ill who can't be returned to the community?
Well, I think proportionately that's part of what has happened. Individuals with mental illness are the hardest to divert, but the most important people that we must divert. The jails are the wrong place for them. It's really a shame that in the 21st century in America, we're providing more acute mental health care in our jails than we are in our hospitals.
As the commissioner of the New York City Department of Corrections, do you have any power over the culture of Rikers and how it operates? And what kinds of things did you have challenges with, and what kinds of things could you actually control?
Well, certainly you have some power, but it, you know, changing a culture like that takes a lot of time. I had two perceptions. One was that in some ways, Rikers Island is like Las Vegas. There is this ethic among the staff that what happens on Rikers stays on Rikers. And in some ways, the city's reliance on this island, sending these individuals, the prisoners, away, demonizing them, stigmatizing them in that way, permits that kind of culture to exist. It's the city telling the staff that we really don't care about these people very much, and so whatever you do to them is fine with us. They're out of sight, out of mind. The second part of the problem was that the staff, I described them as the B team. We be here when you come and we be here when you go. They've seen commissioners pass through. The pension system allows the officers to leave after 20 years. And so your experienced managers leave quite promptly. And it takes time to change that culture.
Martin Horn was the commissioner of the New York City Department of Correction from 2003 to 2009. He's now a distinguished lecturer at John Jay College of Criminal Justice. Thanks so much, Martin.
You're welcome.
Support for The Takeaway comes from LegalZoom. For over 10 years, providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings, legal plans featuring attorney contract review, and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
And now we're going to have a conversation about the sound of public radio, its voices, and what those voices communicate besides the news sometimes. I'd like to introduce Chenjerai Kumanyika, who's an assistant professor of popular culture at Clemson University's Department of Communication Studies. Welcome.
Hey, what's going on, John?
So, Chenjerai, this is your authentic voice. This is the voice I would hear if I just sort of came up to you on the street.
Pretty much, yeah.
And you would say that's a clearly identifiably black voice.
I think so. I mean, I kind of want to resist the idea that there's, you know, like one authentic black voice. But I think a lot of us play that game when we listen to the radio, right? We kind of say try to identify the ethnicity through the voice. So mine is definitely in the black lane, you know.
Black lane. I like that. And you're a big fan of public radio.
Huge fan.
All right. And so as someone who's listened for a long time and then decided to take the step to actually do a piece for public radio, you were a part of the J. Allison Transom Project, right?
That's right. An awesome project over there.
Yeah, and part of the mission is to get different kinds of voices into public radio, right?
That's right.
So what happened as you began that process?
Well, I had written my script for this piece about John Towski, who's the manager of the Avalon Tuna Club, you know, one of the first big game fishing clubs. And I was reading the piece, and I realized I was hearing this other voice in my head. You know, I was kind of imitating maybe like a sort of an Ira Glass, Roman Mars-ish thing. And then I was like, yo, how am I going to sound reading this kind of piece? John Towski is a fisherman, you know. John Towski, this and this and that. And it was kind of like this softer vibe, you know. That doesn't sound anything like Ira Glass, but it was just me trying to imitate what I heard, you know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. There's a quality to public radio. Let's listen.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
I'm Ira Glass. Back next week with more stories of This American Life.
It's easy to parody that sound because it's so identifiable. What do you think is going on there?
You know, there's kind of a standard. I understand that there has to be some standard, I suppose. And what happens, I think, you just kind of like internalize it and you start to try to adapt. It's very instinctive. You know, it's not something I realized really until I listen back sometimes. Like, yo, what am I trying to sound like right here?
Now, what does that say about what has to happen when you're African-American sometimes in different environments? And, you know, whites don't get this situation where you really need to dial that voice in certain circumstances.
I mean, I have a certain way I talk when I'm talking with some of my African-American friends. You know, you're right, it's not racial, but there's a journey I have to take in code switching that I don't think everybody has to necessarily take the same way. You know, because if I greet my friend on the street sometime, like, you know, I just was talking to my friend Minnie Keck this morning, you know, we like, hey, what's going on, man? What's happening? Oh, you know, ain't nothing to it, dog. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, man, I can't call it. You know, we go into all this whole thing. Now, when I greet my colleagues or if I'm addressing people in a professional context, I kind of feel like I'm not allowed to talk like that sometimes. You know what I mean?
Well, here is A.D. Carson. He's a hip-hop artist, poet, he's an author, he's a doctoral student. Listen to what he has to say.
And I'm not against it. It's just that I know that it's a certain type of thing that's going on there. And I think that a lot of that is captured in that voice, in that, you know, warm coffee sipping, you know, like whispering almost. Like it sounds like the whole joint is recorded in the back of Barnes & Noble.
He's nailing it there. I wish he would kind of stop because it's hurting. It's hurting me. In public radio, we think we're diverse. Don't you know that? How could we be sounding so white to you? We're the liberal, diverse group.
I mean, that's the thing that made this writing this piece so sensitive, because that's what I love about public radio. That's what public radio gets right, is that we're bringing in these diverse voices. But there's still those moments. I mean, I just, for listening to it for years, and it really, you know, I think about people who I know. I think about my father-in-law, for example, Khalil Lundy, you know, Force MDs. He just, the way he talks, there's so much beautiful music in how he talks, you know what I mean? And I just feel like he has the kind of voice, though, that in public radio would be very unusual to hear. I mean, I grew up, man, I listen to Frankie Crocker, man, come on.
Tall, tan, young, and fly. Anytime you want me, baby, reach up for me, I'm your guy.
You know, someone who's on public radio all the time, Cornel West, he doesn't pull any punches. I mean, that's his voice. Do you think that's a function of someone's internal bravery, or is it something else?
I think it is. I think it has something to do. You have to build that confidence to kind of just be unapologetically who you are. But there also are standards, you know, and one of the things that has come out in some of the conversations about this are the politics of coaching and how different people have been told, different groups, women, certain things like that are told actually how to speak.
Well, I think it's, you know, really brave of you to go down this road. I think there's, I mean, I sound patronizing to even say it, but I think your voice sounds great. I think a lot of people have said, you know, that my voice doesn't sound like public radio. It's maybe a little too authentic. I don't know, kind of wild sounding. But
edgy.
Edgy, yeah. Oh, God, I hate that word. Oh, man. Yeah, edgy is the new Ira Glass, I guess.
Ira Glass, let me just say, I mean, you know, Ira, you know, when he came out, you know, we were talking about this yesterday on Twitter. I mean, we know that Ira, his voice isn't really typical. He was challenging. He was pushing boundaries. And then that's what happens when you push the boundaries. Now you become the standard, you know.
Ira could tell a story, too. When he was the host of Talk of the Nation for a while, they hated his voice. I think on some level, Ira Glass's voice is kind of like, I'm going to show you. And he changed the standard.
I love the vulnerability in his voice. But, you know, again, I was in Ferguson, and I really started to think about it there, too, because, you know, I talked to so many people from St. Louis, and it was just like the kinds of stories they told. And I was like, see, I want to hear a whole range of hosts that sound like this, or like I talked about my Uncle Carlos. You know, there's so much that's being missed in this framework. So it's just about loving all those voices, man.
Well, I think you're absolutely right. Public means all kinds of voices. I'm sure you found a really welcoming embrace from people in public radio wanting you to go down this road and do stuff. And, you know, good luck to you.
Thank you. I also wanted you to know right now, I actually am drinking some tea. So,
great.
I don't know about warm coffee, but I am drinking tea right now.
I will be going to Barnes & Noble a little later today, where I will have some warm coffee. All right, we'll do this for real. That's great. Thanks so much, Chenjerai.
Thanks, John. Talk to you soon.
Chenjerai Kumanyika is assistant professor of Clemson University's Department of Communications Studies. Super Bowl weekend has arrived. Big screens and buffalo wings, burgers with bacon stuffed with bacon, free-flowing beer. This is the Sports Bar Fan Cave. This Sunday, rent yourself a Jumbotron and draw a crowd. But you've got venue competition. That's right. It's not just sports bars. One of you in Tampa, Florida, I will be watching the Super Bowl from a hot tub in a nudist resort near Tampa while the game is projected on a large screen by the pool. Well, isn't that special. In Riverside, California, one of you is attending a house party at a friend's, but I'm more interested in the commercials, you say.
Hi, this is Nada from Vancouver, Washington. Great place to watch the Super Bowl is at the Oregon Museum of Science and Industry. Huge screen, no distractions. Great place to go.
In Seattle this weekend, you've got the highest concentration of hipsters, Jimi Hendrix wannabes, tech billionaires, and Seahawks fans. Where can you find a crowd? Joining me is Joshua McNichols, reporter for KUOW in Seattle. Welcome, Joshua.
Thank you.
So, Josh, let me just ask you right off the bat, where is this person who's obviously a fan speaking from?
We're going to come out with a victory at the end.
Where did you find him?
He was at the library. He's watching the game on this giant TV at the library where, you know, homeless people and students and business people and families with kids are all sort of together in one space enjoying this big cultural experience.
And this has not been going on for terribly long. Is it Seahawks' success that's really motivated this new open doors policy?
Well, that's a big part of it. But also, you know, the libraries are in this big conversation about what to become in the digital age. And they want to provide access for everybody to these sort of shared cultural experiences. Watching a football game is one of them. I mean, why should people be excluded because they don't have cable or something?
Well, Valerie Wunder, who organizes events at the Seattle Public Library, says that this is really making her dream come true here.
And I have never seen the range of ages and ethnicities and socioeconomic levels that I see when we do the sporting events.
Sounds like a sports bar there in the library. What's it like to see?
Well, there's like 250 people, and it's amazing to share that experience with everyone cheering around you. It's this crazy, diverse crowd of all different kinds of people. One of the guys I talked to is like this conservative evangelical, and another person is an advocate for low-income housing, and they're all together in this one space.
Here's Graham Taylor, who's someone who watched at the game that you observed.
Yeah, I'm homeless, so, you know, that's why I'm here. But I'm glad they opened it up for all people like us, you know. So, yeah, give us a chance to enjoy a game, too. So,
and it's not just homeless people who are at the library. What do you think that says?
Well, I think that libraries have this sort of unique brand, and it's about we're going to be about providing access to these cultural conversations without judgment. You know, why should anybody be excluded from that kind of a cultural conversation? One question I asked them was, if you're just reflecting back to the community what the community wants, why don't you just show like the latest action film? What is it that still makes you a library? And Valerie Wunder, the person who organizes the events there, said, well, we wouldn't just show any old action film. But for example, when Robin Williams died, one of the library branches had a mini Robin Williams festival, you know. When it's part of the cultural conversation, they want to provide that experience for people.
In this egalitarian ethic here, is there going to be a place for Patriots fans in the library, do you think?
I'm sure they would be welcome too. I think I saw a couple of people there that looked a little bit more reticent. And when I talked to them, they were like, oh, yeah, I cheer for this other team or something like that. But this is part about building community and drawing in people who aren't necessarily already part of that conversation. Myself, I'm more of a NPR type person. It took me a while to sort of understand the relevance of the conversation about football as being important, about being community building. And these people who may be out there, you know, just trying to check out a book, get drawn into that. They hear the sort of rumble of the game beneath their feet as they're going to, you know, look through some random book upstairs, and they kind of come down and check it out, and they say, wait a minute, maybe this is important.
Well, as a public radio guy, are the sound systems good?
Yeah, they were great. They were great.
Joshua McNichols, reporter for KUOW in Seattle. Have a great weekend.
Okay, thank you. You too.
We didn't talk about catering at the library. I suppose there will be some crackers and tofu at the very least, but what about some dip for the wings and chips and all those tasty books? We need help, Pashman. Dan Pashman, get in here.
Hey, John.
Get in here. Get in here. All week long, I mean, listen to this dip stuff.
Yeah.
Right? You know, I mean, I like dips. I love dips. But are you a little narrow here? Because, I mean, dips could be anything. I mean, literally anything.
I agree. Anything that you can dip something into is a dip or can be a dip.
Thank you.
Well, you only gave me 4 days.
Oh.
Give me 25 shows and I'll give you 25 dips.
Why should we do anything other than take a bottle of Italian dressing and dump it in some sour cream and stir it around? That's your dip.
Well, that's a great dip. But there's the beauty of dips is that there's a whole world out there. I mean, no matter what your taste, there's a light dip and an entree dip and a spicy dip for you.
One time, my mother made this cream cheese, sour cream, orange juice, and there was something else in there, maybe nutmeg, dip, and you dipped strawberries in it, chocolate-covered strawberries in it.
Wow.
It was crazy. It was insane.
That only happened one time?
It only happened one time. I mean, there was like a crowd of people around the strawberries. It was a mountain of strawberries, and it went to zero, and you could just sort of watch it go down.
That sounds so good.
It was good, man.
Well, one of these days, next Mother's Day, John, I want you to do that for her.
I will do it. I will definitely do it. So what's your final send us off with a bang into Super Bowl weekend dip?
Well, I've been thinking a lot about it. Yeah. John, I've already listed some pretty crazy dips and dip concepts this week here at the Takeaway.
Not so crazy.
I think tomato soup as a dip is a little interesting.
Edgy.
We had the scoop upside down to make it a dome.
Like that.
That's a great one. So for this grand finale daily dip, I hereby select guacamole.
Guacamole. Guacamole. Guacamole. Guacamole. We'd be making guacamole all night long.
Of course. I mean, of course.
It's the everything. It's
made
the everything.
To be dipped.
Can I tell you a quick story, John?
Please.
Seventh grade, I had a great art teacher, Mr. Benevento, and I remember him teaching us that you don't need to color in the whole paper. Leave some areas blank. White is a color too, Mr. Benevento said. And that's such a great lesson in life. When you're cooking, preparing food, white is a color too. Sometimes the best decision you can make in the kitchen is the decision not to do anything more.
So green is the new white?
That's right, yes. Green is a color too. Great guacamole, add something a little bit crunchy in there, whether it's onion, jalapeno, a little kick, a little tart from the lime juice and the sweet and the creaminess. It can be filling. It can be a quick snack. You can do anything with it. It's just so good.
Chunky or smooth? What's your belief?
Oh, it's got to be chunky.
Got to be chunky.
Yeah. You want some textural variety in there.
And the game itself? Come on.
There's a game?
Dan Pashman is the delightfully clueless host of the Sporkful podcast.
When the nachos come along, you must dip it. When the spices are too strong, you must dip it. When the game is on the screen, you must dip it. When the food spread looks too lean, you must dip it. Now dip it into sauce. You scoop it up. Dip back again. Chips forward. Bread ahead. Try to ingest it. It's not too late. To dip it. Dip it good.
And we know you'll be watching the game, won't you?
This is Lexi Palmer from San Antonio, Texas. We sure are watching the Super Bowl with great anticipation of a New England Patriots win. Food, friends, and football.
Follow us on Twitter at The Takeaway, and you can follow me at Jay Hockenberry, and you can go online to thetakeaway.org and cast your predictions for the weekend. Enjoy the game or whatever you're doing this weekend. More of my talk with Chenjerai Kumanyika will be on The Weekender, which you can find on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm John Hockenberry, and this is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.